They Walk Among Us is a podcast exploring the UK's most sinister and surreal crimes, including the woman who killed the boyfriend as he spent too much time on Facebook, to the teenage boys whose online relationship involves spies, sex, and the near-fatal stabbing of one of them. Subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast provider.
Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
As a mother, please, please help us to find our dear Alison. Our lives will never be the same. We must find her.
Because there are three beautiful little girls of Alison's wanting to see their mother as soon as possible.
That's the heartbroken and terrified parents of Alison Baden Clay, fronting media in Brisbane and begging for help in finding their daughter, who was at that stage still missing. Viewers felt their anguish and prayed they'd find their girl. But viewers wondered also, where was Alison's husband, Jared Baden Clay? Why wasn't he appealing to the public for help? Word soon started leaking out that Jared wasn't even part of the physical search to find Alison. While hundreds of people who'd never met her or her family scoured the countryside, Jared holed up with his parents. And then, of course, there were the scratches.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Brisbane journalist David Murray's excellent book, The Murder of Alison Baden Clay, has recently been reissued to include extra material. We had the opportunity to speak with him about the case, beginning with the story of how he first realised that something had gone dreadfully wrong in the innocuous-looking weatherboard house at 593 Brookfield Road.
So I'm obviously a journalist at the Courier Mail in Brisbane, and I was at the time working on the Sunday Mail, the Sunday newspaper, and had a call from my partner, Katrina, who was out at Brookfield and drove past Alison and Jared Baden Clay's house. And there were all these police there, and it was really unusual because Brookfield, for people who don't know, it's this lovely little pocket of Brisbane on the western outskirts, and not much terribly wrong goes on out there. You know, it's kind of like, semi-rural area, a very, upmarket, wealthy area. And it was just unusual to have so many police. And she rang me, and because I cover crime predominantly, and just sort of said, oh, do you know what's going on out there? And at the time I didn't. But this was very early on the first day. And this was Friday, the 20th of April, 2012. And so I made some calls, and then basically, word didn't really filter out for a while to news organisations, and Katrina rang me back again and said, "Oh, there's a forensic van there now," and that sort of really kind of raised alarm bells. Yeah. Because if there was that kind of level of police attention, along with just detectives swarming all over the area, there was something very serious. And it didn't take me very long to find out who it involved, because it's a very sort of small area. I know a number of people who live out there, and I found out very quickly that it involved a couple, Jared and Alison, who were quite well known around the area. A very nice, well-respected family who had three young kids. They were 5, 8, and 10 at the time. And it was very out of character for someone to go missing in those circumstances.
Wasn't it? Also, Jared sort of went out of his way to become well-known, didn't he? He was the kind of bloke who liked people to know who he was.
He did. He was everywhere. He was a local real estate agent, and he was very good at self-promotion. So he had it on his website, he'd do a blog, and, he really hammered these themes of ethics and honesty and trustworthiness, and that was his whole shtick. That was what it was all about for him. He was sort of a kind of like a key member in the local school community. He was part of the PNC. He was on the local Chamber of Commerce. At one point, he was the president of the Chamber of Commerce, and he knew quite a large number of people.
Tell us about the Baden part of the Baden Clay name.
Jared moved to Australia with his family when he was 10 years old, and at that point, they were just the plain old clays. There was no Baden Clay. The Baden part comes in because they have a very, very proud family history, a connection to the founder of the Scouts movement, Baden Powell. And Baden Powell was Jared's great-great-grandfather and, an extraordinary man. There's 10 years ago, they estimated that it's been something like 550 million Scouts worldwide. Wow. This is such a huge movement. And he's a direct descendant of that. They're very, very proud. It's not that long ago, Jared's mother, I think when she was pregnant with Jared, went and visited his great-grandmother in Hampton Court Palace, where she had a grace and favour apartment from the Queen. So they have this link. It's an extraordinary family history. It really is. And I don't think people necessarily really quite realise, but, when I look into it, I found records online of this family history going back 500 years.
Obviously, it was frustrating that no one realised that the Clays were the part of the Baden-Powell dynasty, so they changed it to reflect that.
Yeah, perhaps. Exactly why, I don't know, but, they certainly were, very proud of this history and, perhaps rightly so.
You wrote, what I found interesting about, you writing about Alison's early years was that she seemed to have a real desire to be famous, and she did the ballet at a high level and was a Miss, was it a Miss Australia or Miss Universe competition?
Miss Brisbane, yeah. Miss Brisbane. Miss Brisbane in the Miss Australia contest, yeah.
And, it seems like, was she attracted to, Jared's, he was out there, he was pretty suave. Do you think that was all part of the attraction for her?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I think she was probably drawn in a little bit by the Baden Clay family history, because Jared, I think quite liked to talk about it. And I think that kind of, I think she told her friends, when she met him, how he had this amazing family history and, he was really going places. And Alison herself was going places. Forget about Jared. Alison had just succeeded.
That's right. Where was her career was very impressive when they got together, wasn't it?
Flight center or something. Yeah. She was like a HR director or manager, wasn't
she? Yeah. Everything she did, she strived to do it to perfection. And people, back in the day, they just loved her. I've talked to people who've known her right across the entire spectrum of her life. But back in her working years, when she was just, developing her career, she was a very, very impressive woman. She spoke fluently a couple of languages, including Japanese, but she spoke quite a number of other languages, parts of them as well. And she travelled quite extensively. She set herself up as well really early on. Before Jared, she was actually engaged to someone else, and they had bought, back then, years ago, they'd bought themselves two houses. She'd, I think, invested in Flight Centre back when the shares, were quite low, became very valuable later in life. And she became first, she started working at a Flight Centre, but as in sales and that, but she moved up into human resources to the state manager. Then she became the global manager of human resources. This is very early on when she was sort of just meeting Jared, and he went into Flight Centre and started working for their 24-hour operation, which was basically a handful of people who you'd call day or night, and there was about five of them there. And she was, well above him. And, she literally sat above him in the Flight Centre building in Brisbane.
Wow.
So, she was above him physically as well. So, yeah.
So they were really an ambitious couple. They were on the same page. They were moving in the same direction. They had the same goals. It sounds like a match made in heaven.
Like
when they,
the perfect couple. They're beautiful couple.
Yeah, really. And he treated her like an absolute princess. Back in those early days of courtship years, he called her princess. He did everything for her. She'd go to a hotel for work, and she'd turn up and get into a room, and there be her favourite magazine, that he had arranged for the hotel to be there when she arrived. Very, very sort of thoughtful. Some people view that as actually very, very controlling. So she didn't know or see it at the time, but Jared, I think, had a very controlling element to his personality, like in a big, big way. But at the time, she didn't see that. She just saw him treating her, you know, unbelievably well. And she actually, she had, there's a very, very interesting story where she had a choice between two men in her life. Jared was one and her former fiance. And she told friends how she actually made that decision. And that was when Jared ironed her clothes and neatly folded them for her. And her former fiance kind of just left them crumpled. He was a bit of a man's man. And that's how she chose Jared. And, you know, friends often wonder what could have been with Alison. But, yeah, back in the day, but one more thing I know, I mean, what's very, very interesting is in her diary, she writes this one sentence that just really stands out. And she says, you know, I wish we could rewind back to before we were married. So it wasn't just to, you know, just when we were married, it was before we were married, because I think actually everything changed between them from the moment that they married.
Well, part of that story is the honeymoon. I read your book when I was in India, incidentally, and I was taking malaria medication. And so I read your book and I was like, oh my God. And I quickly ran to my suitcase to see what kind of medication I was taking. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So you have to make a decision then on what you're going to do. So she took this drug, Jared and Alison took this drug. You know, I think it's mefloquine. I think the brand name was Larium. And, you know, it's been shown now to have, over the years, to have very severe effects on some people, you know, sends them into psychosis, especially people if you've got a bit of mental health history.
Some people would say that explains a lot about me, but no, I found out I was not taking that particular medication. No, I'm in the clear, yes.
Yeah, and so she had a severe reaction on their honeymoon. Jared kind of couldn't really handle it. You know, here was this, you know, he kind of said it in court when he gave evidence, you know, oh, she was such a go-getter when I first met her. And then, you know, oh, she kind of fell into this funk. You know, she had this severe reaction to this medication. You know, how long lasting it was, that depends on who you last. There's no doubt it did affect her. You know, whether it had ongoing effects or not, you know, is a matter for debate. But
well, he suggests that it affected her sort of for good, didn't he? He suggested that it changed her personality.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he did. And, you know, she did battle depression during her life. So from that point onwards, at various points in her life. But this is a very big matter of debate because Jared and the Bate and Clays in the trial suggested that she was out of her mind all the time, basically. You know, she's lying around, couldn't do anything. They really portrayed this picture of Alison being a basket case. And so many other people, including a whole range of, you know, counsellors, psychiatrists, friends, family, on and on, I can go on and on, but said, oh, well, she did have depression, but you know, when she realized what it was, she got on medication, she took the medication, she got it under control. And you know, when it flared up again, she got back straight onto medication again. So, you know, this is part of, you know, Jared's attempts to wriggle off the hook for his wife's murder, you know, to portray her as, you know, possibly wandering off into the night somewhere and, you know, falling off a cliff onto a bridge somehow 14 kilometres from home. This is all part of his defence strategy. So, you know, I think we just have to be a bit wary of what we believe there.
And also portraying himself as this amazing father and husband who had to do everything because she just lay on the couch all day and he had to take care of the kids and the house and work and everything.
Well, it's a great pickup line, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm a hero. Yeah. I'm the hero dad looking after, you know, my poor sick wife, you know. And incidentally, he said at the trial he didn't tell anyone, you know, he kept this very, very private. And then so many people said, oh, no, he used to talk about it all the time.
This is the thing that ran through my mind thinking about this case. It's like when someone dies, you know, all sorts of stuff is spoken about them, you know, and Alison can't speak for herself and it must have been so hurtful for her good friends and her family. And you really told the stories of her, you know, friends, her family so well in the book. And I just find it, you know, I think that's why we were all so fascinated by this case.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. Everyone, well, so many people could identify with Alison. You know, she you know, didn't always have it easy. You know, it's pretty tough when you're trying to raise young children. You've put your career on hold. You've devoted everything to your family and your kids. She would not regret, I think, for a second, anything that she did for her kids. But, you know, you've got this husband who you find out has been cheating on you for years and who is not the person that you think you've married. You know, she wrote that in black and white in her own words, in a letter that she wrote. You know, you are not the man that I married. And, you know, she had given up everything for her family and, you know, and it really fell apart. And I think lots of people are in that kind of situation where your relationships, you know, they don't quite go the way you expect them to go or, you know, life's tougher than you kind of expected.
It's you know, not as fun when everything gets serious with kids and bills and mortgage, you know. I think...
No, exactly.
What was their financial situation, by the way? They were living in this beautiful part of Brisbane, Brookfield, which is upmarket, but they were renting, right?
Yeah, as Jared said just before he was arrested and commented to a police officer, you know, we're on the bones of our ass. And, you know, sorry for the language, but that's a direct quote. And, you know, they were living in Brookfield, but they were renting a house and had been renting this house for years and years. So he's selling properties all over the place. You know, he's a real estate agent. That's his job. But they're renting this house. It was a bone of contention for Alison's family, who kind of went, well, what's going on here? You know, Alison in her 20s owned two houses and had share portfolios and everything. And now they're in this kind of situation where, you know, they're in a house that's kind of falling apart. You know, paint's peeling on the walls, there's vines growing over it. Jared, you know, did not have a green thumb, did not like going in a garden. It was quite, you know, from what people tell me, it could be, you know, sometimes a depressing kind of place to go to, you know. But, you know, I guess we've all got houses that, you know, we'd like to keep better sometimes. But
well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I'm not casting aspersions on anyone who rents a house, but it seems as though Jared in particular painted a certain image of himself in the community that in reality was not the case.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's, I guess, what I'm trying to get across as well is that, you know, he was this super, you know, successful businessman, or that's how he liked to portray himself.
What happened when they moved offices?
Yeah, so the finances had gone terribly. So he opened a real estate agency first in Kenmore and decided, the interesting story behind that is that he worked for an agency next door and then suddenly left and just said, oh, no, I'm opening up a new agency myself. And it's next door to you, so we're going to be neighbours. Great news. And they kind of looked at him and went, okay. And anyway, so he opened up his first agency with his family, with his parents, who he'd always worked with in real estate. You know, he'd even, for his first sort of job interviews, he'd gone around to people and said, look, I'm interviewing you, you're not interviewing me, and if you employ me, you have to employ my parents as well, which is this, you know, really odd kind of situation. Mm. No one had ever seen anything like it. Anyway, he thought they were going to be bigger than Ben Hur, and they moved to this huge office, you know, in a different suburb that had no sort of foot traffic and, you know, enormous amounts of rent that they had to pay for it. And then the real estate market just dropped out. The floods hit Brisbane in January 2011. No one could sell anything. And, you know, they were all broke. Like, he was broke. He was begging people for money. He was ringing you know, the local MP who he'd befriended through the Kenmore Chamber of Commerce and begging him for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, $300,000 or $400,000, not just a little loan, you know, big money. He got his mates, his best, his closest friends, all plunged their own money into it to help save him. They rescued him, gave him about $90,000 each, so $270,000, and went into his business. They've lost a lot, of course, now that I'll never see that again. And, you know, he was still kind of thinking he was this kind of super businessman trying to live up, I think, to every, you know, his parents' expectations, everything that had been expected of him his entire life, his own view of himself, this image he'd created of himself. And it was just a disaster. Like, and imagine then if he was then going to break up with Alison and have a very sort of messy divorce and, besides everything to do with all the kids and what would happen to them, financially, he just could not be in that situation, which is, I think, part of the reason why their marriage continued through all the dramas.
Because she probably would have been all right if they'd split up. She sounds like, well, the kind of woman who was very savvy, very good with her money, very talented, and I think
I'm
she probably would have been
sure
all right.
She would have been. Yeah, she would have been, but she did not want that.
Yeah,
yeah. Not in a million years. Like, yeah. She fought for that marriage harder than anyone probably has ever fought for a marriage. Like, she did not want that marriage to fail. You know, there's lots of reasons for that, but she really wanted it to work, and she was prepared to, you know, to tough it out. She wanted to work through with it, so they were going, you know, to counsellors and all this kind of thing. He was kind of showing, like, he kind of was stringing her along. Like, he'd go along, give her hope that it was going to work, but really he wasn't really trying. Like,
so cruel, isn't it?
He maintained these affairs. He was just stringing her along, I think.
In your book, The Murder of Alison Baden Clay, which is so great, you had access to a lot of Alison's friends, family. I'm not surprised, because the more you talk, the more I think, God, if she was my friend or my sister, this would be, even before she died, such a frustrating process of watching such a great woman be reduced to this situation.
Oh, imagine going through it. And, you know, the friends, and they all feel so bad still. You know, 5 years down the track, they kind of all still have sleepless nights, and they all blame themselves, you know, which is what you do. You go, oh, why didn't I do something else? Or why didn't I kind of intervene more or help more? They don't deserve any of that at all. You know, they're actually really lovely, lovely people, but you would. And so a family do that as well. It's very, very hard for them to live through. And, you know, no one really wanted to talk when I started researching this, but over time, you know, over a matter of years, because as we sort of talked about, I started working on this on day one, and over years, through every court appearance and so on, gradually people kind of felt a little bit more comfortable and started talking to me about it too, because they wanted the real story out as well.
Yeah,
they didn't want
this. That's the sense I got from the book, definitely.
Coming up in Australian True Crime, we'll hear about the other woman in Gerard Baden Clay's life. If you're new to this podcast, you might want to take a stroll through our back catalogue, which includes stories of some of Australia's most terrifying criminals, including the man who is the winner of that title, in my opinion, Dennis Allen, who ran a crime empire with his mum, Kath. Was Kenny dismembered in the bathtub? Or something?
There was one who was definitely dismembered in the bathtub, and I also heard tell that at one stage Kath was vacuuming up sort of the remains of Dennis's handiwork, you know, bits of bone and stuff like that from her carpets.
Welcome back to Australian True Crime. We're talking to David Murray, author of the excellent book The Murder of Alison Baden Clay. And we pick up the conversation by introducing the other significant woman in the life of Gerard Baden Clay, Tony McHugh.
So Tony McHugh was one of Gerard's staff members in his real estate business. You know, she felt a spark for Gerard as soon as they met. You know, she was in another relationship, had young kids. Gerard sold the family home for her, sold her and her husband's home, and that's where she met him and the family. He hired her to work in his business. And then over time, an affair developed. You know, the trial was told all about how this happened to a degree, in that started one night in their real estate office, and then it just went on and on and on for years, like for more than 3 years. Eventually, Alison found out through the school grapevine, through the gossip on the school grapevine, when people were talking about it. Everyone was talking about it. Like, it was a school trivia night, which, you know, we all go to and we love.
Yep, we do.
And imagine that, you know, everyone's talking about how Gerard's having an affair with a staff member, Tony McHugh. And then in the following days in the tuck shop, they're all talking about it. And one of her friends, Wendy Moller, got to her, and she just went, what? Like, Alison has to know, and she told Alison straight away.
Oh, good on her.
And Alison confronted Gerard when she rang him, and said, we need to meet. he knew instantly what it was about. And they, I think they met in like a Macca's car park.
The jig was up cars. And he knew he was in trouble.
Yeah. But what's really interesting about the way she reacted, and it just speaks volumes, and it's really relevant to later on, to the night of her murder. You know, she didn't fly off the handle. She didn't, you know, throw things at him like she could have been perfectly justified in doing. Yeah. You know, she just sat next to the car, kind of in the gutter with her head in her hands, in total disbelief, could not believe, you know, he'd done that to her, because she had asked him point blank, have you been having an affair? And he'd said no, like looked her in the eye. She writes this in her journal. He looked me in the eye and he said no. And she could not believe that he'd pulled one over like that. And why I think that's so relevant to later on, to, you know, the 19th of April 2012 when she's murdered, is that, you know, like, she's not the kind of person. There's been no, I've not seen one thing that shows she flies off the handle, her personality. She, you know, she's very probing, and she might be kind of inquisitive, and she might like keep going at him with questions, but she's not going to, from everything I've known, attack him, which is one thing that's kind of been suggested, that somehow she's attacked him and he's defended himself, and in doing so she's, you know, accidentally died. Like, he's never actually said that happened, but they've kind of said, well, this could have happened. You can't prove that didn't happen. But her reaction when she found out about the affair with Tony, I think, you know, can help us rule that out.
Oh, I think she was just so broken by him by that stage. Yeah. Alison's cousin, Jodie Dan, was a domestic violence counsellor well before any of this happened. Jodie said that she had been controlled by Jared by systematic emotional and financial abuse for years.
Yeah, so Jodie saw right through Jared. Mm. You know, Jodie knew Alison back when she was with her former fiancé, and to go around there for dinners and have nice, you know, cheap pastas and a bottle of wine. It was all very relaxed. And then afterwards, when Alison was with Jared, the contact kind of really kind of shriveled. And she was concerned about Jared. And the moment that Jodie heard that Alison was missing, she said to her family, Jared's done this. Mm. And, you know, it's one thing to say that, but then she picks up the phone that first day and rings Crime Stoppers and says, Jared has done this. And, you know, at that stage, Alison's only just been reported missing. And, you know, any number of things could have happened. But that kind of showed her gut instinct about Jared and his controlling behaviour in her experience with what can happen in those kind of relationships.
You know, when the police first arrived at the house, David, do you think if it wasn't for the scratches on Jared's face, they may have not suspected him straight up? Or I just found that the scratches just look
so unbelievable. Dodgy. They look so, like, clearly like, yeah, three fingernail scratches, yeah, down his face.
Yeah, the scratches nailed him. That is totally, yes, totally. Every single person who turned up, with, yeah, the exception of his sister, who said she didn't really notice, everyone else looked at his face and went, what's going on with your face? And, you know, he'd woken up that morning, reckoned that Alison wasn't there. He said, you know, he kind of started shaving, and he reckoned he'd cut himself shaving. And, you know, his daughter started waking up, and he got one of them to, you know, put a Band-Aid over it, told her it was from shaving. You know, he's building this story. And
I mean, unless he was shaving with, yeah, a barbecue fork, I don't know how on earth,
yeah,
shaving could have created scratches like that. It's just crazy.
Well, yeah, look, certainly there are, I think from memory, about four expert witnesses on this kind, on in that area, and every one of them said these scratches are consistent with fingernails, with a scratch, but these are not consistent with a shaving. We, you know, they couldn't rule it out. They couldn't say, you know, it's very hard to rule anything out, but they kind of went, we don't think this there's any way this is from shaving. But, you know, he basically had come up with this story and he stuck to it. He stuck to it the entire time, but no one believed him. And everyone, you know, the problem with that is you've got, you know, everyone shaves, or they've got a husband who shaves, or a brother or a father, and no one had ever seen anything like it from a shaving injury. And so immediately the alarm bells went off for police, and they went, no, hang on, you know, you might be Mr. Respectable, you've got no criminal history, but, you know, instinct says something's not right here. We're going to shut this place down and make it a crime scene. Police did their job, I have to say, in those early days exceptionally well. They followed the book in terms of, you know, they could have just kind of left it, as you see often in missing person cases, you know, days later they actually start to, you know, to do something serious, you know, but they reacted on day one, really started investigating, and a lot of it is down to those scratches. Yeah.
And he tried to plant the seed that Alison had run off because he mentioned to the cops at the time that, oh, I've been having an affair, and she was pretty upset about it, didn't he, when they were at the house?
Yeah, yeah. But he said, you know, I was having an affair, and, it, you know, he basically said the affair was over, it had finished, which was a lie. You know, the affair wasn't over. It was continuing because he had ended the affair, but he'd started again with Tony McHugh. They were still seeing each other. He was telling her, this is in the days, weeks leading up to it, in the hours that he was leaving his wife, that he even gave her the deadline for when he would be out of the marriage. And it was 1st July that year. That you know, that's the financial year start, but it's also Alison's birthday, so it's a particularly cruel day to be picking to leave your wife. And you know, yeah, look, that relationship had just continued, but he told the police that it was over. But yeah, and he tried to get his story straight with McHugh. You know, he rang her and said, "Oh, what have you told? Have you told? I just want to know one thing. Do they know that the affair's still going on?" And she's with police at the time, and she goes, yeah, they do.
Did she suffer a lot of blowback after it all came out, just in her day-to-day life? I mean, look, she's having an affair with a guy. You don't expect the person you're having an affair with to kill their wife. No. So she's, I guess, a victim of this too. I don't want to paint her any worse off. But
yeah, I don't know how she is, you know, as of today. But her life, you know, when all this was happening and the trial and everything, her life was ruined by Jared. You know, her name was Mud, and she was genuinely in love with Jared. She absolutely fell for him, fell for, you know, his story completely.
And she thought he'd leave Alison for her.
Well, he told her he would, and he just kept on saying he would, and she wanted to. And, you know, she did the right thing, you know, when she fell for Jared, you know, and they started this kind of affair. She couldn't live with that and stay in a relationship, and she ended the relationship. And Jared didn't. He stayed in his marriage, and I think Tony McHugh genuinely loved Jared. I think she was totally sucked in by him, and I think she is another victim of Jared.
So how did the story play out for you then from that first day when your wife phoned you and said something's going on in Brookfield? And then the story comes out that a lady is missing, and then her husband, Jared, fronted the media, didn't he, on that first day with the scratches on the face?
No, he didn't. And that's been one of the big things in those days, that he never did that. Like he did, there was one very famous thing when he did speak to a camera, but he just wasn't anywhere. So everyone was going, oh, like this poor woman, mum of three kids, everyone do everything you can to find her, get the word out. Oh, where's her husband? And, you know, as you do, every journalist was turning up on the doorstep of Jared's family saying, oh, you know, do you want to talk to us about Alison? And they were just going, get off our property.
Wow.
And Jared did not want to.
You think, you know, he'd be like, please help us find Alison.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't want anything to do with it, and there were various reasons for that, because he obviously knew police were very, very suspicious of him. You know, he, on the very first day, he called a lawyer, he got a lawyer involved.
Let's not forget the fact that he already knew he'd murdered her, so no wonder he was feeling timid about presenting himself to the media.
That's right, and he's got these scratches on his face.
Yeah.
You know, he starts to grow this beard, you know. Became known as the Beard of Guilt because, you know, he's a very clean-shaven man. He just started growing his beard. It was obviously to cover up the scratches on his face. But he just would not – he just was nowhere, you know. I'm told that police asked him to do an appeal, and he wouldn't do a public appeal. That was done by Alison's parents, Priscilla and Jeff Dickey, at police headquarters, a very, very emotional appeal. This started becoming bigger than Ben Hur. Like, it was huge because – you know, you've got this mum, she's just missing, she's out there somewhere, it's cold, like, what's happened to her? And meanwhile, there's no husband, and everyone's going, well, what's going on? Like, this is a respectable member of the community. Where is he? The only time he spoke was, I think, on the Tuesday. So he reports him missing on a Friday. On the Tuesday, a single news crew's outside his house very early, and he's walking in the house, and they run up to him. You know, you've all seen footage like that, where, and they go, Jared, like, will you talk to me? And he says, and he said, like, the most pathetic kind of appeal you could ever do. It wasn't even an appeal. He just, it was more about him and, oh, you know, they're doing the best they could, just trying to look after the kids, which he tried to, which he said all along to explain why he wasn't present at the search zone or why he wasn't, you know, leading the charge to find his wife.
Good evening. The husband of a woman who mysteriously disappeared from her Kenmore home last Thursday night has broken his silence to Nine News.
I'm trying to look after my children at the moment. They've got three young girls, and we really trust that the police are doing everything they can to find my wife, and we just hope that she'll come home soon. I've spoken to the police about everything, and I've had no contact from her at all.
Alison disappeared last Thursday night and hasn't been seen or heard from since. Her mobile phone is also missing, and her bank account has been untouched.
Was she upset before she went away?
No, and the police, I've tried to help the police as much as I can, and we all have, and everything we've got, so thank you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and that didn't help his cause at all, because we all watched that video footage. You know, people who knew him, who I was talking to, who thought he had nothing to do with it, watched that one moment where he did speak to camera and just went, oh, that is not like him. That is not him at all. This is not the kind of outgoing person, you know, that we know. And they were very, very suspicious of him.
So 10 days after she went missing, 10 days after Alison Baden Clay went missing, a man was kayaking, right, in the sort of the far reaches of Colo Creek?
Yeah, that's right. So Colo Creek comes off Brisbane River, and, you know, it's not an area many people go down. There's no reason to be down there, really, generally. It's not like a bushwalking kind of area. He just, you know, was kind of curious. And so, yeah, took his kayak. I think tide must have been up, because it can be impassable at low tide with the branch that's across it. Yeah, went down, and yeah, there she is. And, you know, she was basically lying underneath this bridge, Colo Creek Bridge, and police were obviously called and found that it was Alison.
Poor Alison.
Yeah, the man says, I realised it was Alison based on her clothes, because a mannequin dressed as Alison had been shown on TV.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Why police use those mannequins, you know. When you look at those mannequins sometimes and you go, oh, that doesn't look anything like, you know, the victim. Why are they doing this? Mm. They don't actually, you know, they're not trying to replicate the facial features. They're just trying to get the clothes are the sort of one of the key things. And, yeah, clicked to him straight away. He knew it was her. You know, it was, you know, you can imagine, a very, very awful place to be at that point.
I can't imagine, you know, honestly, because it's such a sort of creepy, deserted stretch of creek. And
it really is. Mm. And, you know, they showed those images from the crime scene during the trial, and, you know, at the very start of the trial, and of Alison, and they kind of, like, I think, go right in there. So they're the kind of things that really burn into your brain. Mm. You know, if you shut your eyes, they sort of pop up, and you see it, and you just can't forget it. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible scene. And then obviously word started fielding out to all the searchers who'd been looking for her for, you know, relentlessly for 10 days, and obviously to her family, and who were, of course, just, you know, completely devastated.
So, what do you know happened now that that Jared is in jail, and I guess as much information that's ever going to come out is out? What do you know about the final moments of Alison Baden Clay's life?
You know, we've sort of spoken how financially they were just in a world of trouble, at least in Jared's mind, you know, but also everything was coming to a head with his relationship with his affair with Tony McHugh, who was becoming increasingly fed up with him. And so the day before Alison goes missing, the day before she's reported missing, Alison goes to the hairdressers. Jared gets straight on the phone to Tony, and they talk, and he says, oh,
Yeah, by the way, that conference you're going to tomorrow, Friday, 20th of April, Alison's going to that too. So Tony's in real estate, Alison's in real estate. They're both going to the same conference in the Brisbane Convention Centre the next morning. First time they're going to be in the same room together with all of their colleagues. Uh-huh. Tony McHugh, who is not like Alison at all, hits the roof. You know, in her own words, you know, I lost it, she said. And she just gave it to Jared over the phone. She's like, what are you doing? And, you know, when are you going to tell your wife? When are you going to leave your wife? And she wasn't just taking, oh, yeah, you know, soon or whatever. She wanted details. And she said to him, well, what are you going to do first? Are you going to sell your business or are you going to leave Alison first? When he sort of said he was going to sell the business. And he's trying to answer. Tony McHugh's blowing up. He's not backing down. There's no way Tony McHugh's not going to that conference next day, and basically tells Jared he has to sort it out. So this is, you know, around that sort of 5-6 o'clock mark PM on the night before Alison's reported missing. He goes home, and his story is they have a discussion because that week on the Monday, a counsellor that they'd both gone to see had given them these sessions to do, 15-minute sessions where she said, Alison, you can ask Jared or you can say anything you want to Jared for 15 minutes, and he just has to sit there and listen. And you do that every night or every second night. Recipe for total disaster, yes. You ask me, because Alison's gone, yeah, great, and has prepared the most detailed list of questions you'll ever see.
About the affair, isn't it? Where did you have sex, how many times,
Exactly. And so she's asking these questions, you know, some of these questions that night, some of them, you know, in the previous night. He's just got off the phone from Tony McHugh. He's giving him a hard time. You know, you can just see a situation of someone snapping. Alternatively, you know, perhaps this was something that was planned or loosely kind of fantasized about even by him, because Alison had $1 million worth of life insurance policies and he was a sole beneficiary. If he got away with it, if he could get away with it, it would solve all of his problems. He wouldn't have a financial problem anymore. He wouldn't have a marriage problem anymore. You know, he could do whatever he wanted. And so all these issues are coming to a head on the night that she goes missing.
His family still completely supportive of him. Who do they believe killed Alison?
Well, they stand behind Jared 100%. Have, as far as I know, still do, have, you know, to this day. They don't know. They've got their own theories, obviously. You know, maybe she's gone off for a walk and someone's abducted her.
Right.
Or maybe she's gone and taken her own life. And, you know, maybe someone else is responsible. But when it came down to it at the trial, you know, Jared eventually went to trial in mid-2014 and, you know, really came down to these key planks of evidence. Basically, there were the scratches on Jared's face that indicated there was close quarter combat. Police, when they examined Alison's car, found in the back third row seating area on the side panel a trail of blood going down the side of the car, inside the car. There was very, very important evidence from her remains, from her body, of leaves that were found with her body, which a botanist in Queensland, Dr. Gordon Geimer, through unbelievable detective work, and, you know, this is one of the most extraordinary stories of the whole thing, of what he did, the level of attention to detail that he did, basically established that the leaves that were found with Alison's body did not come from the area where she was found. Mm-hmm. In fact, that they came from her garden. She died at the house. You know, her body had come in contact with the ground, because don't forget, Alison had been to the hairdressers that night and for a recolour of her hair. You know, her hair should have been pristine, but here it was with these leaves from her garden caught up in her hair. And that was another key piece of
evidence. As though she'd been dragged, yeah. Right?
Yeah, that's right. She'd been in an area where these leaves had come into contact. And if you go onto the back patio area of their house, there's all the trees and there's all the plants that were found in her hair. Fishbone fern, crepe myrtle, Chinese elm, you know, lily pilly. They're all around in that area, you know, fringing this kind of back patio. And so you can imagine a scenario where her body has been on the back patio at some point. And ultimately, you know, a jury deliberated for a number of days, very, very carefully weighed up all this evidence and convicted Jared of Alison's murder.
So Jared now is serving a life sentence for the murder of Alison, his wife, in Wolston Correctional Centre. What sort of, I read a story from the Courier Mail from a couple of months ago saying that he's paying other inmates to act as bodyguards for him. Do you know anything else about how Jared's time's going?
Yeah, look, that's a story that's gone around. I haven't been able to verify that, so I don't know if it's true or not. It was definitely reported and by, I think, a TV channel first. But, look, we've heard his friend, he's become friends with Max Seeker, who's a triple murderer in Wolston, and very unusual friendship, that one. You know, he's kind of, he does a bit of work, you know, he did a bit of cutting of hair of the inmates. He apparently he, you know, pushes a trolley around to take meals around to inmates. He works in the snap section, which is the metal kind of work area. So he's keeping himself busy. You know, I was once sent a letter that he wrote, and it talked to, where he talked about the things that were important to him: the four F's, friends, family, faith, and fitness. Oh. And they were the things he was saying were getting him through.
How nice for him that he can concentrate on his fitness and his friendships in jail, while poor Alison, you know, the kids have got no mum or dad for that matter, because he's in jail.
Yeah, and that's the ultimate, the worst thing of all of this is the effect on, you know, their three young kids, I think, you know, who have lost their mum. You know, they've lost their dad. You know, they're very fortunate that they've got a strong support network in, you know, the extended family. They're being raised by Alison's parents with the support of other family members. They've had enormous community support, which will help them, I think, as well financially. And, you know, from what we're told, they're very resilient girls dealing with, you know, unimaginable circumstances. And you can only wish them the best.
Yeah, definitely.
Congratulations on this book. We got the updated edition that's just come out, The Murder of Alison Baden Clay by David Murray. As we said earlier, it paints such a thorough picture of Alison as a woman that I felt like a friend of hers or maybe just another admirer of hers, you know. And so congratulations on that. It's brilliant.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. And if you know someone who you think would like to listen but is still a bit scared of podcasting, please let them know that they can now hear entire episodes on our Facebook page. That's Australian True Crime on Facebook.